On this episode of Most Notorious, the legendary Western outlaw Butch Cassidy.
So to beat the posse, Butch would have, first of all, he'd start out with some great horses. He was a great horseman himself. And then a few miles out of town, he'd have arranged for some gang members and horses to be waiting there for him, fresh horses. They'd ride a few more miles, get off, switch horses again. You could see what I mean. By this time, the original posse's horses would be completely out of gas, and Butch and his guys were off to the races. So they escaped many times using that simple but very smart maneuver of tying up the horses.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Most Notorious podcast. I'm Eric Rivenis. Glad, as always, you are joining me today. Many of us are familiar with the name Butch Cassidy, primarily because of the 1969 movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But he was a real outlaw and had a life far more interesting than the fictional version played by Paul Newman. Anyway, let's begin. It is so great to have as my guest today Charles Learson. He is the former executive editor of Sports Illustrated and has written for Rolling Stone, Esquire, and the New York Times. Some of his titles include New York Times bestseller Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, Crazy Good, The True Story of Dan Patch, The Most Famous Horse in America, and Blood and Smoke, A True Tale of Mystery, Mayhem, and the birth of the Indy 500. But he is here today to talk about his latest work, entitled Butch Cassidy, The True Story of an American Outlaw, officially out on July 14th. Thanks so much for your time today.
Eric, I'm happy to be here with you.
Yes, this is great. So you are primarily known as a sports historian. What prompted a shift for you into the true crime, Old West genre?
Well, I did write a book about a famous racehorse at the turn of the 20th century, and I did write a book about Ty Cobb, who came up to the major leagues in 1905. And I wrote a book about the first Indy 500, as you said, which happened in 1911. My interest is not in sports so much as it is, although I am interested in sports, but it's that era. You know, it's that time, that fascinating era, I think, between, say, the 1880 and the First World War, and how things changed. I happen to think, and I'm not alone in this, but I happen to be one of those people who think that it was the most exciting and innovative time in American history. I mean, even more so than the advent of the internet in the last 20 or 30 years, as big as that's been and as fundamental as that's been. I mean, if you think back to the era that I'm talking about, the 1880s until 1920, roughly, you see so many things happen. I mean, the advent of electricity throughout America and the world, and the advent of any number of inventions like the airplane, the automobile, the telephone, and movies, and just a shift in American life that was created. You know, big time sports came up, and this move from the family farms to the cities, and all this upheaval that this caused throughout American life, for both good and bad. So that's really what I'm interested in. Butch Cassidy fits squarely in this era, or pretty squarely anyway. He was born in 1866, right after the Civil War. He's from that post-Civil War generation in the West, and he died in 1908, although some people will want to debate me on that point. But so he fits squarely in this era, and his story is really the story of the end of the Wild West and how it was getting harder and harder to be the kind of cowboy outlaw that we've come to think of and know so well from so many big movies. That was the theme of the movie, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, too. But it's one of the few areas in which reality and that movie overlap. So that's a kind of a long answer to your question. It's not so much sports, it's that fascinating time.
There have been many Butch Cassidy historians over the years, as you document in your book, but they've often come with questionable research, personal agendas, etc. Was it difficult to sort through these narratives and siphon them down to a truthful and accurate account?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. It was. I don't want to whine about how difficult. But every book has its challenges, and the challenge for me about writing about an outlaw after coming off a book about a baseball player, Ty Cobb, the contrast was incredible. I mean, with baseball, you have teams, they have rosters, they have schedules. You know where they are. They're out in the public as part of their reason for existing. They do things in public. And then each town where they went, each big city, you had in those days six or seven newspapers writing about the game or about what was going on the team at the time. With outlaws, it's pretty much 180 degrees difference. These guys are trying to elude notice and run away from the spotlight. They're trying to put out red herrings and false information. Then you had a layer of misinformation supplied by the newspapers, especially the Western ones, but the Eastern ones really weren't much better when they covered Western outlaws, with exaggeration and sensationalism. I mean, Butch Cassidy was reported dead more than 50 times during his career, and in none of those cases was it his actual death. I'm not even counting that. So there's a lot of, I say in the book, I think that you feel like you're on marshy ground when you cover these guys. And then there's the layer, I shouldn't forget, because you asked me about this layer of these historians who have a rather fanciful view of whatever they're writing about and don't feel constrained by the truth somehow. They just sort of spin out tales. I think they feel like their job is adding to the legend, not adding to the facts. So you have these books, and some of them have been really crazy. About one guy postulates that there were five Butch Cassidy clones roaming the landscape. I mean, it gets kind of crazy and gets kind of wild. So you do have to sort this out, and you never know for sure when you're on solid ground. I try to write a book that was as much truth and as little legend as possible, although sometimes it's nice to refer to the legend and say what we know about its veracity and what we don't, because the legend is part of the character.
So let's begin with the man himself, Robert Leroy Parker, a.k.a. Butch Cassidy. What is known about his early life?
Well, we know that he was born in southern Utah, although he always told people he was born in New York City. He was born about as far away spiritually and culturally as you can get. He was born in a little town called Beaver, Utah, and then he soon moved, him and his family, to a place called Centerville, Utah, and in a little cabin there. And his father was a subsistence farmer. And he did a lot of, his father did a lot of other things to make a living. The Parkers, Robert Leroy Parker and his family, were Mormons living in Utah. And his parents had been born in England and came to America as part of a missionary effort on the part of the Mormons, who settled in Utah mostly because it was like a spot where they thought no one else would want to live because of the harsh conditions, and they would be left alone. But then they needed people to come there and live and farm and dig irrigation ditches and raise cattle and do those things, so that they couldn't sign up enough people in America quickly enough. So they went to England, and the Parkers, who became Butch Cassidy's parents, came here and settled in southern Utah and lived there. And Butch was born in America, but he was a first generation child of immigrants who just in a way that it happened all over the country. But say, if you think of like the Lower East Side of New York, a very crowded, different kind of area, those kids that were born there, first generation children of immigrants, the last thing they wanted to do in many cases was travel that same route as their parents. They said, no, this is America. I see the opportunities here. I see the chances here for a less dreary, less difficult life than you're leading. And I want to break out of that. And of course, not everyone says that. Some people just go along and become what their parents were. But Butch was one of that in that first group. He was one of those people that said, no, I want to, you know, just like, you know, you had all those comedians and vaudeville stars and movie stars who came out of the slums of New York City and said, I don't want to be that. I want to go to Hollywood. And that was his impulse too. He wanted to bust out. And in those days, they had an expression. They would say he wanted to go see the elephant. I don't know if this came from P.T. Barnum, but it was something that people said. In other words, I want to get out and see the wider world. I want to go out and see what's out there. I don't want to just stay on this little farm, because it was very easy to just live your life in a few square acres in those days and die in the same bed you were born in. And Butch didn't want to be that kind of person. So that was his background, where he came from, and that was his impetus to get out and leave. The Sundance Kid, by the way, a very different thing. Harry Longabaugh, he very different story. He was born in the East, in Pennsylvania, near not far from Philadelphia, and he got his idea of the West from dime novels, and it was exciting to him and romantic to him. And he, as a teenager, he got on the train in Pennsylvania and headed west to live that kind of life. So those two guys eventually met up. Actually, they met up kind of late in their careers, which is why the book is really just called Butch Cassidy, because Butch is by far, I think, the more interesting of the two. So anyway, those were two paths to the same thing, but they both had that same idea that they wanted to live the exciting life. It was comparable really to being in show business, I think.
Yeah, for sure. So what was his first foray into the wrong side of the law? How old was he? How did he transition from being just an incorrigible kid to a full-blown outlaw?
His first foray into breaking the law was when he was about 13 years old, and he rode into Beaver, Utah from his family farm to buy a pair of overalls. And he got there. It was probably a 6 or 7 mile ride, and the general store was closed, and he was annoyed by that. But being an inventive kid and who made up his own rules, he broke in to the store, took the overalls he wanted, and left a note on the counter saying, "I owe you. I took these overalls, and I'll come back and pay you." And when the storekeeper came in the next day, he didn't really like to do business that way. And so he called the sheriff, and the sheriff and Butch signed his name, or at that time it was Robert Parker. And the sheriff went to his father's farm and said, "I think you better have a long talk with your boy." And the reason that crime is significant at all is because it kind of just shows Butch like making up his rules as he went along, being baffled that the stupid sheriff and the stupid store owner wouldn't, you know, see this as a good solution to his problem. And his father gave him a stern talking to and all. And so Butch had the same reaction to that little crime as he would have all along. Why are these guys following me? Why don't they do something important? Why are these, you know, they're morons, you know, to be spending the time that they're spending on me? I'm just doing what I'm doing, you know. And after that, it got into a gray area. So that was no doubt the first crime he committed, breaking and entering, maybe breaking a window. And after that, things gradually stepped up. The thing about the West, though, and rustling, he was a rustler. That was the real maybe first crime that he could have gone to jail for. He wasn't a kid. He'd steal some horses and some cattle. You know, that was so common, though, out on the range in those days, that people stole from one another, or they'd see some mavericks roaming around that hadn't been branded yet. The local rancher would just round those up and take them to his place, and tomorrow someone would do that to him. And this kind of back and forth, little small time rustling, if you could call it that, was part of the life out there. It became when the big cattle ranches moved out there, the big corporate ranches, they didn't want anyone doing that to their cattle, and they decided to not just prosecute to the court system, but also hang people and shoot people for stealing cattle. So cattle theft was the sort of the entry level crime, which a lot of these cowboy outlaws, you know, got into their notorious life via the rustling route.
So Butch Cassidy's personality, he was charming, the life of the party, gentlemanly to the women. He had a wit to him, a class that the majority of outlaws from his era seriously lacked, right?
I mean, the one word is charismatic. I think he was charismatic in the extreme, and this is what everyone said about him. And it's just you can't learn to be charismatic, or even, you know, teach yourself. You just either you are or you aren't. And this is where the movie gets it right, and the movie gets it right by accident. I assume everyone who's listening to us has seen the movie, maybe not for years. The movie came out in 1969. It's a long time ago, but maybe you've seen it in the interim on TV. The plot of the movie is almost completely made up, but the character of Butch by accident, because Paul Newman didn't do any research, and the William Goldman, the screenwriter, did almost no research, but Paul Newman is so charismatic and so charming and so witty and such a, as you say, classy and gentlemanly. He decided to portray Butch as that, and by accident, they got it right. So if you look at Paul Newman and look at that character, Butch had the funny lines, the funny quips. He was handsome, not as handsome as Paul Newman, but who is? And that was his calling card in life. And people fell in love with him, you know, men and women. They couldn't help themselves. I talked to a guy. I made two trips to South America to research this book. One to Argentina, where they lived for about 5 years, which is not even mentioned in the movie. And one to Bolivia, where they both died. I met a retired judge down there who's in Argentina, who has spent decades researching and studying Butch, and he told me there's a slang word in Argentina in Spanish. It's called extrador, and it means incoming, actually. Not just, it's beyond outgoing. It means incoming. It means I get it inside of you, under your skin, and I that's how appealing that person is. And he said Butch Cassidy was a classic example of an extrador kind of person. Wherever he went, he was charming. He had governors trying to plead for his leniency for him as a result of that, and judges who wrote letters to the judges who convicted him. In one case, wrote a letter to try to get him his sentence reduced afterwards. People just loved him. And if you look at the Paul Newman in the movie and you want to get a quick and dirty idea of what the real Butch Cassidy was like in terms of personality, that's a good place to go.
I know that there are some different versions of this, but where do you think he picked up his moniker, Butch Cassidy?
Well, there are different versions of it. Butch in the mid-19th century was a kind of a brand new nickname, and there's not too many examples of it before, but if you know, do some semantic research, it sort of meant a tough guy, as it does now, even today. And, you know, by the time of like the Little Rascals, wasn't one of them named Butch, or the dog or something. People knew what it meant by that time. I don't know. That didn't exactly fit him. One theory is that he worked as a butcher for a while in Rock Springs, Maryland. And it is true. I found that butchers were sometimes called Butch in the mid-19th century before the word really sorted itself out. So that may be one reason why. But we know why he changed his name, because his family, even though they weren't very strict or religious, they were Mormon people living a good, decent life, and he didn't want to embarrass them. So he started calling himself George Parker for a while. And then somehow, probably because he admired this cowboy that he met when he was working on a ranch, whose name was Mike Cassidy, he borrowed his name. And then somehow, and we don't know, this is one of the things we have to live with when we do research about outlaws in the Wild West, is that there are points that we just have to say we don't know. And that's better than making up some story, as some other people do. So I won't make up a lie that sounds nice. I'll just tell you the fact is we don't know. But somewhere along the line, he started being called Butch, and he served time in prison. His his prison forms and all said Butch Cassidy, so we know that was what he was called at that time. So, but it was a name that it stuck. It went. The newspapers liked it. It sounded kind of cool, and Cassidy sounded kind of cool. So he stuck with it, and it stuck with him.
Well, as long as we're on the subject of aliases, how about the Sundance Kid?
Well, his was applied to him by the newspapers after he was for a while. He served some jail time in Sundance, Wyoming, and that too has a really nice ring to it. And the newspapers started calling him the Sundance Kid. He was young, and you know, Kid was a common name that was applied to any, again, like a tough guy kind of name. And it was applied, you know, boxers used it and outlaws. And Harry Longabaugh was known as something of a Houdini for a while, about getting out of handcuffs and getting out of chains and escaping from his jail cell. And I think he escaped from that prison, that jail in Sundance, and the newspapers covered it a lot and wound up labeling him the Sundance Kid. You know, when Robert Redford played him in the movie, he kind of fell in love with that name, Sundance, and he wound up using it to name a film festival that he started, a TV channel, several other commercial ventures that he got into, a resort and everything that he opened. So he fell in love with the name. And Paul Newman, while we're on the subject of falling in love with your character, Paul Newman fell in love with the Butch Cassidy character and spent the last part of his life, or the part of his life after, the long part of his life after the movie, trying to track down a Butch Cassidy autograph in manuscript shops and rare bookstores, because he said it was the one thing that he wanted that he didn't have in his life. And I don't think he ever got it, but he spent decades trying to track down a Butch Cassidy autograph.
We will be back after a brief word from our sponsors. And we have returned. Yeah, you also write in your book that Robert Redford was so fascinated with the Sundance Kid that he recreated one of the kid's historical rides, right?
Right. He went after the movie. It's quite like 5 or 6 years, I think, after the movie that he organized the ride along the Outlaw Trail, which is a loose collection of hideouts and rock formations where the outlaws hid, that runs from Montana all the way to Mexico, if you want to look at it a certain way. And he rode a great part of that and wrote a very good a book. It's like a coffee table, a picture book, with great pictures and all. I don't think it's in print anymore, but it's probably findable on eBay or Amazon. It's called The Outlaw Trail. And that was, he came back to it almost, maybe it was 6 or 7 years after the movie. So he still had that on his mind and recreated it. They love the spirit of the characters they played, I think, Butch and Sundance, because, you know, they were easy to like because they weren't in it for the money. And they went out of their way not to hurt anyone, the common folk, certainly, not even financially, and not to hurt anyone physically. They had a kind of a unwritten moral code that they followed. So they were very, very easy to like.
Yeah, I do want to ask you about that. Scholars of Butch Cassidy believe he never killed anyone. Not only was he not interested in killing, but there is this Robin Hood mythology built up around him. He was supposedly very generous to people whom he encountered, those down on their luck especially, as he traveled through the West.
Right. He had an unwritten rule, as I say, and he collected these people around him who were master crooks and also master cowboys, in the sense that they had all the cowboy skill set, the horsemanship, the marksmanship, the ability with the rope. And some of them were not very morally healthy people, and they had notches on their gun and they had killings on their resume. But when you were in his company and riding with him, the rule was that you didn't hurt anyone, and you didn't rob from the little man. So what would happen would be, if they would go in a bank, they would rob only the bank safe. And when if they would go on a train and the passengers would be fearful and hold out their watches and their wallets and their jewelry as they walked up and down the aisles, they would say, no, we don't want your money. We want what's inside the, in those days, it was the American Express safe in the express car that the train was carrying. So put away your money. People have studied, in an academic sense, have studied outlaws who've existed, of course, over the centuries and around the world. And it's a very common thing for an outlaw to claim that they have a kind of a populist side to them, that they're out for the little man. But very often that's not true. And it's just the outlaw sort of bragging and trying to paint himself in a better light than reality. Butch and his group, which came to be called the Wild Bunch, actually defined themselves in that way that they were, and it cost them money. They had to take the same amount of risk in the robbery, but they realized less money from it just because they, of what I mentioned, that they didn't take the money from the individual citizens. They took it only from the safe. So they were willing to kind of put their money where their mouth was, and their existence sort of owes a lot to the way the West developed in reality, as opposed to the way we see it in the cowboy movies. You know, what was happening in the West was that a lot of people had been sold a bill of goods by the government and by corporations to get them to move out West. The railroads wanted to build railroads. The banks wanted to move out there. The big cattle people wanted to set up operations out there. And they needed, just like the Mormons needed people to populate Utah, they needed people to go out there and be ranchers and be farmers and borrow money from the banks and ship their cattle back on the trains. And to get them out there, there was advertising done. People took exploratory trips out there, and then they wrote about it for the newspapers, all in the name of getting poor suckers from the East to move out to the West, where, in fact, it was very hard to raise cattle or very hard to grow crops because of the lack of rain out past the 100th meridian, and where these same corporations were going to gouge them in terms of the loan rates and in terms of the shipping rates for the cattle and take advantage of them. So it was almost a dystopian world out there where a lot of people barely hanging on, barely struggling. The golden promise that they've been told wasn't happening. You know, people said, how can I move out there? How can I farm? I'm looking at the records. It only rains a half an inch a year in this part of Wyoming you're telling me to move to. And someone said, there's a famous, one of the promoters used the famous line, the rain will follow the plow. In other words, if you go out there and start plowing and farming, then it'll start raining. You know, and some people actually believe that. Well, it didn't work out that way. The other thing that happened was the government gave out to get entice people to go there, gave out giant size homesteads compared to what they were giving out in the East under the Homestead Act. So you had 160 acres of free land in the West for one reason, because you needed that much the amount you could grow in a square foot and would produce was very low. So you needed a lot of land. But one thing that created was isolation. People were living very far from each other, and they're living far from each other in very trying circumstances. And in the winters, especially those long Western winters, it was horrible. So people drank, they committed suicide. There were horrible things happening. The big cattle companies would come if they wanted your land and they wanted your homestead. They might drag the father of the family out from the dinner table, take him out back and shoot him, and then just take over the land. It was a horrible, bloodthirsty, dog-eat-dog existence going on out there, not what we see in the cowboy movies. And this is what Butch and his gang were pushing back against. That's why they wanted to bedevil and hurt the corporations that were the banks, the big cattle, and the railroads that were making life miserable for the common people in the West in those days.
So outlaws were a dime a dozen in the old West, and most of them didn't last long. Cassidy was different. He planned his bank and train robberies differently than the common criminal of the day, correct?
I think he was smarter than the average criminal. I mean, in this way, I lucked out as an author because, you know, sometimes if you write about old Western heroes, you know, you start out with the image that Hollywood gave you, you know, maybe in a movie in the 1940s and 50s, and that was polished up further on early TV. And then you find out, you do some real honest research and you find out that someone was like a drunken pimp, you know, in reality. And you say, well, what do I do now? Who cares about this person? He just has a cool name like Wild Bill Hickok or something. So, and his legend has grown, you know, because of that. But Butch Cassidy turned out, the more I delved into him, the more I found out about him, the more interesting he got. And the more I thought he was an interesting character to write about and base a book on, both for the reasons that I was just talking about, both because he had this populist bent and this idea that he would bedevil the corporations out there. Now, he wasn't a Robin Hood in the sense that he took from the rich and gave to the poor directly, but he as part of the Western outlaw machismo thing, and here he's not going to sound very smart because he went along with the average outlaw in this sense. After a robbery, they would have a big blowout in the nearest town, and they would spend just about everything they robbed, you know, and sometimes, you know, they wouldn't get all that much. And then they'd have to divide it up amongst themselves, and they'd have a big party. And really, then they were back to where they started from. So in that sense, Butch was no smarter than the average crook, but in every other way, he was. The way he went about and conducted his business, the way he did research, you know, this was a gang, the Wild Bunch and Butch Cassidy, that if not invented, perfected this idea, and it was a revolutionary idea of having a relay team of horses set up in advance. This took a lot of advanced planning to escape, because Every robbery came down at some point to the posse chasing the outlaws. You know, whether you left the bank and the posse chased you, or whether you left the train and the posse chased you, wasn't too much difference. So to beat the posse, Butch would have, first of all, he'd start out with some great horses. He was a great horseman himself. And then a few miles out of town, he'd have arranged for some gang members and horses to be waiting there for him, fresh horses. They'd ride a few more miles, get off, switch horses again. You could see what I mean. By this time, the original posse's horses would be completely out of gas, and Butch and his guys were off to the races. So they escaped many times using that simple but very smart maneuver of tying up the horses. They went so far even as to, you know, if you're a racetrack aficionado, you know that in short sprint races, you want kind of chunky horses with big hind ends that can go fast in a short, for a short distance. And it, for a longer race, you want kind of lanky, thinner, more muscular, but thinner horses. And so they would have them staked out that way. In the beginning, there'd be shorter intervals with the horses, and they put sprinters there. And then the others, they'd have long distance horses at the other end. So Butch was smart this way. He was lucky in some ways too, but he knew that he had to do something drastic as the turn of the century came, because he was getting too well known, him and his gang in what they call the Intermountain West, you know, Colorado and Wyoming and Montana and Utah. And he couldn't hang around there anymore. So they had to do something. So they made this very smart move of heading to South America, which was a drastic, radical, and sort of unprecedented move almost for American outlaws. Very few had even tried that before. And that was also part of, they went down there not to rob banks and trains initially, but they went there to be honest ranchers and see if they could make a go of it as honest ranchers, because they were so good at all the regular cowboy skills. And that was the story of Butch's life, is another reason he lasted as long as he did. I think that he wasn't consistently an outlaw through his career. He swung back and forth. You know, the grass always looked greener to him. When he was an outlaw, it looked so much better to lead a peaceful life as a rancher without the law on your trail, you can sit with your back to the door, and you don't have to worry about constantly be worried about being apprehended. So he'd do that for a while, and when he got there, he got bored, and he realized that it wasn't very exciting, being a rancher. It's mind-numbing work, actually, and very hard work. So then he'd drift back into the life of crime, the fun, glamorous life of crime. So partly because he wasn't consistently an outlaw, I think that stretched out his career too, and also partly was making this kind of mad dash to South America in 1901 with the Sundance Kid and Sundance's girlfriend, Ethel Place, who's often mistakenly referred to as Etta Place, as she was in the movie, but her real name was Ethel. And she was quite beautiful and just as beautiful as Catherine Ross, the actress who played her in the movie. And Sundance was pretty good looking himself and Butch. And they took off for South America from Brooklyn, not far from where I'm talking to you right now, in 1901, and added this strange chapter to their story.
One of the many stories that you tell in your book has to do with the premiere of the 1969 film, and one of Butch's relatives, I can't exactly remember what her relation was, but she commented that she was surprised that the movie was called Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and not Butch Cassidy and Elsie Lay. Elsie Lay was far more of a boon companion to Butch Cassidy than the Sundance Kid ever was, she thought. Could you tell us a little about him?
Yeah, the woman you're talking about was actually his sister, who was still alive when the movie came out. It shows you how close we are to the Old West. And Elsie's grandson, who she was talking to, his name was Harvey Murdoch. He's since passed away since I interviewed him, but for the book. But he was there with her, and they got invited to the premiere in Salt Lake City, and they were standing outside the theater after the movie and hoping to talk to Robert Redford and Paul Newman, and they never got to do that. And she said to him, "I'm really surprised that your grandfather, Elsie Lay, wasn't mentioned." And he said, "I know," Harvey said, "but I guess they figured who would want to go see a movie called Butch Cassidy and Elsie Lay, right? I mean, the Sundance Kid sounds a lot better." So, but the Sundance Kid character in the movie was a composite of Harry Longabaugh, and Elsie Lay. And Elsie was a guy that Butch ran into, on the outlaw trail. And he was smart like Butch. Both Butch and Elsie were big readers of books. They always had books in their saddlebag. And Elsie was sort of an all-purpose criminal. He's related to the potato chip Lay, by the way. But he was a hardscrabble kid at that time, grew up. His father was a Civil War veteran. And he grew up in the Midwest, I think, and he came west, got involved in all kinds of counterfeit schemes and ran a saloon for a while, which is what a lot of them did, because there was better money in selling whiskey, actually, than in robbing banks and railroads. A lot of them found that out. And then they became buddies and pulled off a few. When Butch got out of the prison in Laramie, where he spent almost 2 years, he connected with Elsie. And when Butch got out of prison, he was kind of in a different state of mind. He wasn't so carefree and lighthearted. He was kind of ticked off. He had this quality, Butch, where he was the real Butch, where he was always annoyed and sort of baffled by the fact that law enforcement was spending so much time like bothering with him. Why don't they go do something important and leave him alone? Meanwhile, he's robbing banks and the railroads. So, he didn't have an answer for that contradiction, but that was his attitude. And so he and Elsie got together, pulled off a few jobs. And then, they had this kind of a free form association. Elsie went off and did something else. He got shot very badly, was put in prison in New Mexico for a while, finally got out of prison. And Elsie wound up working for the water department in Los Angeles. And he's buried today in the Forest Lawn Cemetery. He also spent some time as a consultant on very early Western movies out there, as some other cowboys did, silent Westerns. So he had a really long life, lived to his into his 60s. For an outlaw, that was a long life. So he was a colorful character, and a lot of the attributes that you see Robert Redford have in the movie were actually taken from him and his life.
So what did Butch Cassidy do to get himself into prison?
Well, he was convicted of having a stolen horse, but what was happening was there was a lot of rustling going on, cattle rustling and horse rustling in his part of the world in Wyoming. And the cattle people wanted to desperately make an example of someone. And Butch was this sort of charismatic, high-profile guy. If he wasn't the biggest rustler in the world, then he was maybe the most famous rustler. Everyone knew his name and everyone talked about him. So if they could get him convicted, it would be getting the word out to everyone else, you know, don't do this, you'll be punished. So they went after him, and they originally charged him with stealing one horse. His lawyer got him off. He was found innocent. But while he was sitting in the courtroom, they were so desperate to convict him, they served him with another set of papers that they're going to charge him with stealing another horse. That trial was delayed several times. Finally, he was convicted. The horse was worth $40, I think. It was charged with stealing a $40 horse, which was significant because anything more than $20 was, what's the word? I'm blanking on the word.
Grand larceny.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It was grand larceny.
That's okay.
And anything more than 40. So they gave the value of the horse as 40. But then when the judge smacked down the gavel and said he was convicting, when the jury came back, he said, I'm convicting you of stealing a horse worth $5. It didn't make sense, but the court system in Wyoming in those days was kind of, as I say in the book, like a Little Rascals version of the legal system. So it was kind of, they're making it up as they go along. So somehow, and he said, I'm convicting you of stealing a horse worth $5, and I'm sending you to two years in the state penitentiary, which is the punishment didn't fit the crime. The crime wasn't the crime he was charged with. Nevertheless, they put him on a train and they brought him to Laramie to put him in the prison. And he wound up serving, he got out 6 months early, and the judge who convicted him wrote a letter to the governor saying he's a remarkable young man with leadership qualities and he should be let out. And the guy who owned the horse wrote a letter, you know, came to see the governor, and everyone, you know, was trying to get Butch off from the charge he'd been convicted of. So that's what he served time. And it was a harsh prison. I visited the prison. It's a tourist attraction today, but you could still see what a harsh and cruel place it was, even though it's kind of gussied up and for the tourist trade nowadays.
So Cassidy robbed a lot of banks and trains, and obviously we don't have time to get into the vast majority of these heists here on the podcast. It would take hours and hours. But what was the job that put Butch Cassidy on the map as a national figure?
It might have been the Wilcox train robbery, which is an obscure part of Wyoming, which is about the third robbery he pulled off after getting out of prison. And it was very well planned. They had the horse relays. They had everything. They had a lot of dynamite with them. They kind of overdid it with the dynamite sometimes because they'd first ask the train crew to open up the express car safe. When the train crew wouldn't do that, they would escort them off the train, put the dynamite in, and then blow up the train. And in this case, they used so much dynamite that they sort of wound up singeing and burning a lot of the money that was they were going after. And they also blew up, there were a bunch of raspberries being transported on the same train, and they created this like flying raspberry jam that went over everything and made the money very easy to identify later as stolen bills. But the telling thing about that robbery that made him a national figure, I think, was that by this point the news was carried by telegraph. And E.H. Harriman, the railroad baron, who was a Union Pacific Railroad train that they knocked off in the middle of the night, that morning in New York City in his Fifth Avenue mansion, E.H. Harriman was able to pick up a copy of a newspaper and read about his own train being knocked off just hours earlier. And that was both increased Butch's fame, which is not necessarily something an outlaw wants to happen, but it also was a signal, a sign that it was the beginning of the end for the traditional Western robber, because once the telegraph got in and you could telegraph ahead and communicate ahead, if you could, you know, any, if you can go faster than a horse with your information, it was very hard to escape and pull off an escape. And then you could communicate with the telephone, and then you could distribute accurate information that could be used to, you know, round up the outlaws. So as soon as the telegraph came in and was started to be used widely, that was, you know, a smart crook like Butch knew that was a bad sign for him and his 19th century kind of style of being a bandito.
One final break as we hear from our sponsors. Thanks for hanging in there. Back to the show. What is the crime he's most famous for now?
Well, I don't know if there's one crime. You know, it may have been that, for the reasons I said, that got the most newspaper coverage because the word could go out more. The one he should have been most famous for was his last crime, because that's the one he got the most money for, which was committed in Bolivia and was, again, an old, very old-fashioned kind of crime. Butch standing on foot in a mountain pass in the Andes, where I stood also. Before I say the Andes, I'm not sure it was part of the Andes, but in a mountain pass, intercepted this three-man crew that was coming through carrying a mine payroll. And they had, in Bolivian money, they had the equivalent of $200,000 in American dollars today. And that was actually a small amount. Butch and Sundance were disappointed that they only got that much. It was a slow week on the payroll trail for some reason. Anyway, that was in 1908. In the spring of 1908, they pulled that off. And that was the one where he got the most money. It also, I don't want to give away too much of the book, but it was very near the time where the movie ends with that kind of compromising. The movie ends, if you remember, with a compromising scene in which they make a run for it, and you hear shots, and you don't know what happens in the end. I don't want to give away too much of the reality. It's very interesting, but there, the end of the trail was not far away from them at that point where they stole that money. But, you know, it was a series of ups and downs for Butch. His fortunes would come and go. He'd be rich for a little while. He'd blow it all at the faro tables, at the gambling tables, or he'd blow it all at a big party. And that was part of the life, actually. Maybe it's not as stupid as it seems, because that was accepted as part of the life. You didn't get into this business of being an old-fashioned cowboy outlaw to make money, to build, you know, accumulate a lot of money and retire someday, or you know, build a mansion someplace. You couldn't live like that. You had to keep moving. And that was the part of the life that he didn't like, that sort of haunted aspect to the life where you could never rest. His life is a series of fascinating highs and lows and ups and downs. And at the end, it was the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows came very close together.
Would you consider Butch Cassidy a ladies' man?
It's an excellent question. You know, he charmed the ladies. He liked to talk to them. There are Western scholars and outlaw scholars who make a case for him having been gay. And part of this is, you know, little bits of circumstantial evidence that he had certain nicknames as a kid. He was called Sally in the family. And he never really, we can't pin him down exactly to, he was very squirrely about women. And also later in his life, when he was in South America, he sort of made a big pretense about saying what a ladies' man he was. He went out of his way to say that they would have these like traveling whorehouses that came on it, like they were wagons being pulled, and he would go out of his way to brag about how he patronized these and how he had town disease, he called it, which was probably gonorrhea as a result of it, whether that was true or not. But the very fact that he was sort of boasting, not boasting so much as just wanting everyone to know this, had people scratching their heads. And when he went to South America, and in the time just before that too, he was like the third wheel in the relationship with Sundance, Ethel Place, and him. And Sundance and Ethel were obviously an item. He told Sundance told his family they were married, whether they actually were or not, we don't know. But Butch was always like the third wheel in that relationship. So it's hard to say. Women certainly liked him, and he liked their company. But what went on beyond that, we don't know.
There were a couple of sisters, the Bassett girls, who did claim that he had some trysts with them, right?
Yeah, the Bassett sisters, they liked fame. They liked being portraying themselves later in life. And they lived, at least one of them, until the 1950s and you know, would get interviews where she really fluffed up, I think, her outlaw credentials and who she slept with, what outlaws she were her lovers and things like that. And and it may be that they're telling the truth, too. And it may be that Butch was sometimes heterosexual and sometimes not. I mentioned in the book, there's been some research done about what it meant to be a homosexual in the West in those days, in areas where men outnumbered women by 30 to 1. And there was a different attitude towards sex in both the 19th century and in that part of the world where you weren't seen as a homosexual if you'd had sexual relations with a man. That was just what you did for, you know, they called it mutual solace. If you remember the, you know, Brokeback Mountain, the movie, that was the short story, that was the term. It was not talked about too much, but it was also not judged as it would be later and in other places.
Oh, interesting. So leaving the details of their deaths a surprise for readers, not a problem. But I would like to ask you about the controversy surrounding Cassidy's demise.
Sure.
Some believe he wasn't actually killed. Can you address that and what you personally believe?
Yeah, well, I think the circumstantial evidence that they died in Bolivia, and there are, I don't, that's not giving away too much because there are quite a few twists and turns and surprises in what happened in the last days. But the circumstantial evidence is kind of overwhelming, and circumstantial evidence is important. You can get convicted and executed on the basis of circumstantial evidence. So it's not a small thing. It is true that we have no direct evidence, and it is also true that people claim that they saw one or the other of those guys, especially Butch, into the 1940s in the West. Now, two things about that. One is, it's a very common thing with outlaws, if you study outlaws broadly, that people did not accept their death, even in cases, you know, with like Jesse James, or where there are pictures of his corpse, and people did not accept that. And they didn't want that. They wanted the story to continue. They thought it was a more interesting story if, in this case, if Butch came back and outfoxed everyone by living a, you know, starting a new life and living a life in the U.S. All of these guys, too, guys like Billy the Kid, Jesse James, Butch Cassidy, they all had impersonators and imposters that sprung up that went around saying they were them. And Butch had a guy, we know his name is William T. Phillips. He actually may have known Butch and been in the prison in Laramie with Butch. So he had a lot to say. He wrote a book, Phillips, that he tried to sell to Hollywood and to publishers, which it has since been published. It's called The Bandit Invincible. It's very hard to read. It's not very well written, but it's historically not accurate. So between the impersonators and the desire in the part of the populace to keep their heroes alive, you know, Butch was a hero because he outfoxed the sheriff and because he bedeviled the corporations. He was a hero. The money he stole worked its way back into the local economy via the parties he threw and the just the general generosity he had of giving out a lot of money as he went along the line. He wasn't exactly a Robin Hood, but he was involved in the redistribution of wealth in the sense that he would steal it from the corporations and then blow it on big parties and celebrations in the local towns, and it would get put back into the local economy. One of his ex friends said later that he helped more people than FDR and a lot less red tape was involved. So he was beloved for that, and people didn't want to see this man perish and die, and they certainly didn't want to see him like die because he'd been outfoxed by lawmen who'd been chasing him. So that story was kept alive. But every one of those stories, I think, has been debunked, and the only people who still propagate it are the researchers who also say that he knew Lawrence of Arabia and Madame Curie and tell fantastic tales. They're the ones that say he lived into the 40s. So I'm sorry to say that that's not the case. Although I also am realistic enough to know that I'm not going to extinguish every last ember of belief that he did live until, you know, the World War II era.
Right. That reminds me, I don't know if you remember that television series called the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. In every episode, he met an important figure or was involved in a pivotal moment in world history. That's kind of what you're saying.
Right. Yeah, it's a great, makes for a great story. And people, I know from my past books, and especially my Ty Cobb book, and all, people will, they'll believe, they'll favor a great, you know, when the legend, what is that line from Liberty Valance, the movie, when the legend beats the facts, print the legend, you know, there's a natural love of great stories, and people will turn themselves into like historical novelists and take characters from real life and spin, give them, have them doing things that they never did. And, you know, it's my job to kind of not be the party pooper, but to find what's interesting in the reality. And I think in the case of Butch Cassidy, the real story is just as fascinating as anything that's ever been made up about him.
Did you find yourself becoming fonder and fonder of him as you plowed through your research?
Yeah, it's like, it's hard to find anything about him that's not to like, you know. There's a rather lengthy letter that he wrote to some guys he worked with in a mine in Bolivia, reproduced in the book. And in that book, part of his thing where he's trying to do this pretend machismo, he talks about being very cruel to this donkey and like beating the donkey and breaking his jaw with a rock. And all. I don't think he was really doing it. I think he was just trying to be like, yeah, I'm as crass and as vulgar as you guys. And that disappointed me, you know, because everything else about him is so interesting. And, you know, he's a guy that could approach when he approached the guy who was carrying the payroll of $200,000 in Bolivianos. He said, you know, excuse me. He said, I hate to inconvenience you, but you're carrying a lot of money and we have a great need. You know, that was the way he operated as a criminal, politely. And it is a fascinating way that they dressed up in good clothes because they wanted to show that they were professionals. And they sometimes spoke in a very stern and scary way, but it was all about intimidating the people that they were dealing with in the trains and in the banks. And so they wouldn't have to use violence and they wouldn't have to use brute force. You know, they would try to talk a good game and show a good game. They would show up, you know, bathed and all dressed up and be professionals about it and get by that way with a maximum of professionalism and a minimum of violence. And so, you know, they're very admirable guys. You can't help falling in love with Butch.
I have a question that I wanted to ask you earlier, actually, and I got sidetracked. You were talking about the Wild Bunch. Besides Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, there were some other pretty fascinating characters riding with them in his gang. One in particular was an especially violent man named Kid Curry. Could you talk a bit about Kid Curry?
Yeah, Harvey Logan, his real name, wasn't he? He came from Montana, and he was a little crazy. And I've seen like letters he wrote when he was in jail, and he was a little bit like, the letters are a little bit like the Unabomber letters. He had a brother or two that was also an outlaw with him, and he's a real desperado. As I think I say in the book, I'm trying to remember the line now. He said he didn't just kill people; he killed people in Jew Jake's saloon. You know, it was all this tough, harsh, vulgar life that he lived. And Butch wasn't judgmental about him. He accepted him into the gang because he admired his marksmanship and his horsemanship and his ropesmanship, if that's a word. And but he kept him under wraps, and he had to talk to him a couple of times. There's a fascinating exchange that the newspapers reported on it, that Wilcox train robbery where Harvey cracks the engineer over the head with his pistol, and Butch says to him, you know, back off. He said, you know, we're not going to hurt anyone. You'll kill someone if you keep this up here, you know. So he was a wild man that Butch had to keep under wraps. And Harvey Logan was also, one part of the myth was that Harvey Logan was with them in South America. That wasn't the case, because Logan committed suicide after he was cornered after a train robbery that after those guys, the rest of the gang went to South America. And as frequently happened in those days, if a guy was cornered, he might kill himself rather than face those endless stretch of years in those Wild West prisons. So Logan was a wild man, and very much in contrast to Butch Cassidy.
And Butch Cassidy was very particular about who he allowed to join the gang. And at one point you write that his own brother, Dan, begged to ride with him, and he pretty much brushed him off, didn't he?
Right. He said, you're too slow-witted, you're too easy to catch. And shortly after he said that, Dan was involved in some stagecoach robbery and was caught and was sent to prison for a long stretch. And the sort of interesting thing is that the nearest federal prison was in Detroit, and I think the crime was committed in Wyoming. One of the big things that allowed the outlaw culture to spread was that law enforcement was so thin on the ground in those days. There were so few lawmen. There might be a sheriff and a deputy here, and then you might have to go 600 miles before you found the next sheriff and deputy. And the prisons and jails were very far apart. And, you know, transporting a guy from where you arrested him to the jail was often a trip of several days. And so that got complicated, you know. So but Dan was never, you know, Dan went straight after, and I think had a long life. He moved back to the family farm in Utah and lived there with Butch's parents, moved back home.
So give us the details of how people can buy your book.
Oh, great. Thanks. The book is called Butch Cassidy, The True Story of an American Outlaw, and it's published by Simon and Schuster, and you can find it on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Bookstores are open in your area for curbside pickup or whatever the deal is. It's a major publishing house. My name is Charles Learson, and my website is learson.com. It's very hard to spell my last name because it's Leerhsen. But if you look up Butch Cassidy, True Story of an American Outlaw, you'll find me, and then you get to my website. There's an excerpt there. There's information about the books, information about my other books. If you're like me and you're fascinated by this period of American history, the late 19th century, the early 20th century, then you might find this book and some of my other books entertaining. I hope you do.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been great.
Well, thanks so much, Eric. It's been fun talking to you. You made it easy.
Again, I have been speaking to Charles Learson. His book is called Butch Cassidy, The True Story of an American Outlaw. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.